Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, September 7th, 2001. In the Creekside room this afternoon is Cynthia Gustafson. Today's session number is GUC 2001-5, and it's titled Here and Now. Let's listen in.
Shelton Whispers, this is session 5, September 7th, and this is Cynthia Gustafson. And session 5 is called Between the Shelton Whispers, the Here and Now. That's what we take. This is the fifth of 5 sessions, and you know, it didn't matter if you weren't here at the other ones, but I was just kind of going to kind of review what we've gone through. The first day we did God Calls Your Name and Shouts and Whispers Through the Wind, and I interpret the wind, the Hebrew word ruach is wind, breath, Holy Spirit. So we talked about how do we find that spirit in us, how do we hear it through the wind, those kinds of things. The second day, was through the waters. And of course, this goes, you know, with the scripture that calls your name as you go through the waters. And I interpreted the waters as the waters of birth and baptism. So we talked about how we hear God through family. And sometimes this family make it easier to hear God, and sometimes family makes it harder to hear God, and all of those things that happen within family. The third day, we talked about God calls your name and shouts and whispers through fire. Of course, the scripture says you shall walk through fire and not be burned, and you shall walk through fire and it shall not consume you. And we talked about how do we hear God in the midst of adversity, you know, and all those bad things that happen to us, because things happen to all of us. And sometimes we do get burned, and the burn stays with us through life in certain ways, but it doesn't consume us. What is the role of God there? Day 4, yesterday, was God calls us through the rivers, and I interpreted that as through nature. So we talked about how we hear God through nature, and all of us, you know, were a little different there, and how we hear God calling our name through nature. Well, today is the fifth day, and I have decided to do, how does God call our name between the shouts and the whispers? And God isn't screaming at us, and God isn't whispering, and we're not out here in Holden, and we're not having a crisis, and we're just at home in our everyday world. How does God call us? How do we hear the call of God? How does God call our name in the everyday? So that's what we're going to talk about today, and I have some poems to present, and we'll talk about different aspects of those. This little poem that I have up here, William Carlos Williams is an American poet who is also a physician. And he wrote this: it's difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. Shows how important I think poetry is. Okay. I'm going to start out with a poem from my book. This poem is called Rising Backwards. And now we'll talk a little bit about it after I read it. When I learned to write my name, it slanted backwards. Even when teachers slapped my knuckles, the dancing flow of letters filled a space no other writer owned, and no teacher could persuade me to abandon. And later on in school, I loved to study the reasons ancient people wrote on walls. And I loved to juggle geometric puzzles, proving theorems back to their origin, where thinking backwards was to my advantage. When I bought my 10-speed bike, I pedaled backwards, no gear to slow rotation, flowing up and down like bubbling oil. But of course, the bike went nowhere, only my feet were in orbit. When I play a set of tennis, I win with a strong backhand. Opponents try to outwit me by putting the ball behind, but my mind is seldom in front, and my two-handed return is powerful. I prefer the back of the bus, where I can feel the road beneath, and I've been known to scrawl under my Victorian porch in the cool dog-haired dirt, all the while thinking that the flip side of life is most certainly not death. It's more like when I get chained into my seat, facing forward in a swinging bucket of a double Ferris wheel, and I swiftly rise backwards through enormous space, up and around, my flying hair leading, face coming last, surprised and weightless. Now, there's a lot here. I mean, there's even something very quite theological at the end there. But the whole idea of this, and the reason I wanted to start with this one, is that I started with something that everybody used to criticize in me. You know, I didn't write the way I was supposed to. It was supposed to write very neatly this way, and I wrote backwards. I wrote, you know, this way. I'm right-handed, but I wrote backwards, and the teachers didn't like that very well. And so when I started writing this poem, I started thinking about all the backwards things that I do. There are lots of things that I do backwards. And toward the end of this poem, I'm celebrating what I do backwards. And the reason I brought this up is because, for those of you who are new here, too, let me tell you a little bit about my background. I'm a psychotherapist and I'm a poet, and I use poetry in psychotherapy. And I work with people all the time who have been told, for one reason or another, that what they do is wrong. You know, who they are is not very good, it's not good enough. And so I ask people to think about those things that others have told them are wrong, and to think about what is right about those things. You know, if I want to write backwards like that, that's okay. I can even celebrate it. Let's see, what were some of the other backwards things that I do?
The bike.
Yes.
The bike.
Have you ever pedaled backwards on the bike? That's really fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't go anywhere, but it feels good. It's cool. And then I talk about having a good backhand. I really don't. I'm not a great tennis player, but it sounded good in the poem. But the whole idea is that you take something that somebody has told you isn't very good about you, and you celebrate it. And why I'm starting with that is because I'm kind of hinting about self-esteem and how we feel about ourselves. And I want to ask this question. How do we hear God in our everyday life when we don't like ourselves very well, or if we have low self-esteem? Or if that has never happened to you, think of a person you know that does have low self-esteem and ask yourself, how do they hear God calling their name, or how do you hear God calling your name when you think you aren't very good? Do you remember when you were a teenager? Maybe some of you are like this as adults, but do you remember as a teenager feeling really gangly and you just didn't quite know what to do with your body, and it just was hard to walk across the cafeteria? Am I the only one that was like that? But you know, we've all had those times when our self-esteem has been really low. And I ask the question, because the scripture says God calls your name, right? How do you hear that call when you feel like you aren't worth anything? Do you have any ideas? This isn't a lecture. Does anybody have any ideas or any stories? Can anybody remember a time?
Mm-hmm. I don't care anything specific, but I think a lot of it comes that sometimes we forget to look for God in the ordinary.
Yeah.
And we think it has to be extraordinary to be meaningful.
Right.
And I think that's a big lesson that I have to stop reminding myself of every once in a while.
Right. A couple years ago I led a retreat which was on that theme, finding God in the ordinary.
Another thing is, I went to a workshop that William Deal, he's a lay person in a Lutheran church that has his focus on ministry and daily life.
Uh-huh.
And the one example that stood out to me that kind of fits this is, this one woman couldn't think of anything that in her life that she could name ministry. That was too big a word or something, had a different connotation. And she was one of the persons that would do anything in the church, you know, bringing casseroles, having guests stay at her house overnight, all of these types of things. And, Ministry of Hospitality is what they finally, and it did wonders for her acknowledging God working through her in the ordinary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one. That's a wonderful story.
So I think that naming and claiming can do stuff for your self-esteem.
You need to help people find it.
Yeah.
Yes.
We have a daughter who's gone through all the struggles of teenage and then some have been through alcohol treatment and had a child out of wedlock and all kinds of things. And she has a job answering telephone for a newspaper, taking orders and canceling orders and paying bills and things. And she finds lonely people call up. And she talked an hour and a half to one fellow whose wife had died. And she listened.
Wow.
You know, and we tried to point out to her what a wonderful ministry she has by being there. They know her number. These lonely people keep calling.
Isn't that wonderful? I don't know if her boss would like that, but that's
wonderful. They're really pretty good about it.
That's great. That's great. I don't know how many of you went to the Bible study this morning with Pastor Peter. Well, I can't tell you to go anymore because I think today was his last day. Or is he here next week?
No, he left today.
You missed something wonderful. Anyway, he was talking this morning about accepting your vocation. That doesn't mean the way you earn your living, but, you know, where your heart and your spirit are and where you put, you know, your real energy and your vocation. And several people gave examples of calls that they had and they needed to, you know, do a specific thing once they were called. And one was called to missionary field, and one was called, the one that Peter talked about was called to make, to teach how to make quilts. And they made 100 quilts in the church every year and gave them away to charity. And it was so wonderful. But my question is, thinking about this poem and thinking about how we feel about ourselves at certain times in our lives, how do you look at ourselves and say, God's calling me to that? How? How could God? I can't do that. It's like Moses this morning saying, I can't even talk. How can you call me? So I think there is something that is all mixed up in self-esteem and, you know, how we feel about ourselves. And Moses had the advantage of having God right there in the burning bush. Say, don't worry about that, you know, I'll be with you. And I guess we have to remember that, you know, and read the scriptures to remember that. But I think that's all I'm going to say about the self-esteem issue. But it's something to think about, you know, how do we hear God calling our name, you know, and calling us to something if we don't think we're good enough to do that thing. Okay. Next one, this is also from my book, Prayers and Poems, and I want to read this because a lot of us are going to say God hears us through our prayers, and that is absolutely right. But I want to discuss this poem when we're done. Prayers and Poems. I never finished a nighttime prayer when I was young. My endless list of needed blessings included a cousin's lost dog, children with broken arms, like mine when I was 6, jaundiced great Aunt Agnes, and people going to the dentist. I even prayed for God to dry my neighbor's mouth so he couldn't swear or spit. And then I wanted Dad home safely, Mom's eyes not to hurt, Grandpa to stop hiccuping, and a certain person to notice me. Was it because I always fell asleep before the Amen that my prayers weren't answered? Dad, Agnes, and Grandpa died. My cousin got a new dog. Mom's eyes still hurt, and now so do mine. I hear my old neighbor's an army recruiter, and kids still break their arms or have them broken. Did I ask for the wrong things or use the wrong words? Because that certain person did notice me. It's what I prayed for, a spotlight dance where they called our names and we met under the twirling lights and danced, stiff at first, then closer and softer, until I wanted to do what the lyrics suggested, put your head on my shoulder, but I didn't. And when the music faded and the spotlight dimmed, he walked away forever. I still have lists of needed blessings. Before I go to sleep, I write them into poems. Okay, let's think about this. This is the voice of a little girl, isn't it? A little girl who has a list of all these things. This is you're supposed to say your prayer. This is what you pray for. All these people who need your prayers. People who are having all kinds of troubles, whether it be physical problems or having to go to the dentist tomorrow or whatever it happens to be. And so that's the way a little girl sees praying. And what happened, this is like, I'm writing this when I'm 13 years old. I didn't write it then, but I mean, that's the voice. So what happens when I'm 13 years old? Those three people that I was praying for all died. The dog died. They had to get a new one. I mean, none of the things I was praying for changed because of the prayers that I was saying. Except for that last one, I wanted somebody to notice me. His name was Mark Campbell. And he did notice me, and they called this spotlight dance only because my best friend told them to do it. And we had to dance in front of everybody, and I just thought it was wonderful, but he just walked away after that, and that was the end. So that didn't come true either. Okay, so what am I saying about a little girl's prayers? And how do I finish this? Now as an adult, I still have lists of needed blessings, but before I go to sleep, I write them into poems. Okay. I'm not saying don't pray. That's not what I'm saying. What am I saying?
Is that another way to talk to God?
Well, it certainly is for me. Writing poems is another way to talk to God. But I have changed. I've totally changed what my idea of prayer is. Were you going to raise your hand back there? No, you're just... See, I should have gotten some CDs to hand out every time somebody said something like Pastor Peter did. People that talk really well. Anyway, I'll have to do that next time. The reason I wrote this is because I was finding that I didn't like what prayer had become. And so I wrote it in the tone of a 13-year-old child because I was looking around and thinking that a lot of us as adults were praying as 13-year-old children do, asking for things like you'd ask for Christmas presents. And I didn't like that. But let's talk about prayer because I'm not saying don't pray. In this context of what we're talking about today, how do we hear God shouting to us or whispering to us in our everyday life, in our work, in the doing the dishes at home, all those kinds of things? How do we hear God through those kinds of prayers? Does anybody say prayers at work ever? I tell you, I do it all the time.
I feel like it's almost a constant dialogue. But I'm all alone.
That's very nice that you have that blessing to be home alone. Are you doing housework at home, or do you do a special kind of work at home?
Quilt, but I have to keeping house, you have to do something.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I'm a psychotherapist, and I have people in my session who bring to me the worst problems anybody has because they can't solve them themselves until they come to me. And it's an enormous burden, and one that I don't take lightly. And I pray constantly as I am working with these people. But I don't say, God, give these people more money. That's not what I say when I pray. Do you understand?
I think another way, too, that we should be praying is all of a sudden you'll be sitting there and somebody will cross your mind that you haven't seen for years or something like that. Uh-huh. And I think that's when you should stop and start praying for that person.
Right. Because there may be a reason that
that's right.
That name flashed into your
right.
head.
Yeah.
That's very good. That's good. I'm going to go home with a whole lot of new suggestions, and that's one of them I'm going to do now. That's good. How about when you're driving in the car and you're just about to get to the point of road rage?
Or calming.
Yeah. Well, it puts us into perspective again, doesn't it? I think.
I think when you wake up early in the morning, too, is a good time to talk to God.
There are lots of reasons for that, I think. Well, first of all, because it's not, your brain isn't cluttered with all the other stuff, you know, unless you wake up just like that and you're ready to go. But you're also still in your alpha waves from sleeping. You're really using a lot of your right brain and, you know, your creative side, your holistic side, and I think it's easier to pray that way. Okay. Does anybody have any other times during their day when they find it's a good time to stop and pray or to do it?
I know this sounds maybe weird, but
it won't be.
We have two hospitals in Sioux Falls that both have helicopters.
Uh-huh.
And any time that the helicopter goes over, it's hip prayer because it's always an emergency. They're not going to go out unless it's an emergency situation.
You're right. That's wonderful. That's so lovely. Let me just say this short little story, because you know many of you know about my husband, but some of you don't. My husband was in a very severe car accident in March, and he's not up here with us because he's in a wheelchair. But we went in a helicopter because the accident was in Arkansas, and he had to come over to Oklahoma, the hospital. So we went in a helicopter. And you know, it was so interesting because this accident happened in Arkansas. And you know, people call Arkansas and Oklahoma the Bible Belt. And most of the time I do that too, and I do that in a pejorative way because most of the time that's not a good term when I say that. But let me tell you the part of it that was wonderful. And that is that every single person that I came in contact with, the nurses, the receptionists, the doctors, the taxi drivers, the bus drivers, every single person that I encountered prayed for us and told us. You know, it was just outright, I am praying for you. I'm not talking to you during this because I'm praying for you. I mean, it was really unbelievable. And that can be something if any of you are ever in, you know, that kind of a situation, to know that that's really helpful for the person that's going through it.
What are they praying for?
Healing, health, that doctors will do their best, that, you know, I'm not exactly sure what the words are, but
to go back to your first poem about when the prayer doesn't come true,
right.
Then what?
Well, that's a very good question, isn't it? Because we always know that some of them don't come true. But you know, if you pray for doctors to do their best, that doesn't mean that someone will survive.
No.
And you can always pray for strength. The people can, you know, the caregivers, the people around it will be strong enough to get through. There are lots of things like that you can, you know, pray for without specifically saying, you know, I want this ending. and the question is, you know, is it okay to say, you know, I really would like it to be this particular ending, but, you know, if it be thy will, so that you know that it doesn't come out that way. That if it doesn't come out that way, it's okay. Okay, and I should also say that I am not a minister, okay? I have a little bit of a theology background. I was in the seminary for a while, but I'm mostly a psychotherapist and a poet. So I'm kind of throwing out ideas and then also talking from my own life here. Did you have
a, just a couple things you talk about. Prayer, my husband is a clergyman,
mm-hmm.
and he always felt a lot of strength because he knew his mother was praying for him.
Uh-huh.
And felt a big loss when she died. But I feel like she's still...
Yeah.
And then there was an elderly parishioner who was in a nursing home and who had lost her limbs because of diabetes and was blind. This woman could do nothing except pray. And she made it a point of telling him that she was praying for him. And it just meant so much to him. So,
uh-huh.
You know, we really can do a lot.
Right, right.
It's a little town that I worked in when I was in high school. And there was a woman in that town that was called the Prayer Queen. She was confined to bed, but everyone in that town knew that she was praying for
them. That was a nice term. Because when you say the prayer queen, it almost sounds, you know, like they're making fun of someone, but it really was a very lovely term. Wow. That is neat. Okay. Here's a poem which I'm going to put on here. We'll talk about it after I read it, but this is a change from what we've been talking about. It's called Park and Shop on the Bad Side of Town. And the little words under it says, Park and Shop backwards is Posencraft. If you switch the letters, okay? KG, that's my son, Kent Gustafson. That's what he said when he saw Park and Shop. He says, Park and Shop backwards is Posencraft. Okay, well then I started thinking about what this particular store was like. At the Park and Shop, you come to be seen. You come to pose in clothes with the right labels and step inside the shelves of crap. Cigarettes, booze, stems of satin roses for 75 cents a piece, with cardboard heart and space to sign your name or your ex. Here, iron bars protect windows with faded pictures of half-nude ladies and their Johnny Walker Red posing for cowboys in jeans tight enough to make them sterile. Here they sell rolls of lotto tickets, used ones underfoot, all hope of winning gone. Life's a gamble, for at night designer label jackets hide guns and bullets. No turn of the bin for winners and losers, just the turn of the barrel determines who gets trampled underfoot at the Park and Shop. I wrote this poem when I lived in Shreveport, Louisiana, and there was this Park and Shop, and it was in the bad part of town. You would not get out of your car and go into the store. And it did have iron bars, you know, all over the windows. And this is exactly, I mean, there was a shooting there every night. It's exactly what I'm saying. Okay. My question with this one is, how do I listen to God amidst all the junk in my world? Okay. Now here, I'm not even going to go into the violence part of it, but how about the junk in this store? You know, the cigarettes, the booze, the Johnny Walker Red, the lotto tickets, all the junk that just is garbage in our lives. You know, what is it that we leave behind when we come up to Holden Village? You know, we all know what that junk is. How do we hear God? I mean, even shouting to us in all of that junk. Does anybody have, any stories or experiences with how you kind of part your way through all of this junk? This can even be defined as how much time we spend doing what I would call junk. You know, just fill up our day kind of stuff. We have so many things, except you people who are retired. But I hear that people who are retired start filling up as well.
Yeah. Still have junk.
Yeah. But my question is how do we hear God through all of that junk? You know, is there a way? How do we make ourselves still enough to hear anything?
I don't want to dwell the talking, but we sure don't.
It's okay.
We don't watch television. I mean, we go for quiet.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, that's one of the ways to do it, because television is a filler-upper, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It will fill up any time that we have left that we don't want to sit and think or ponder or pray or whatever. TV will fill it up. In our house, my husband would have liked to have never had a TV, but we did. But we've always only had one. It was always in the main living room, so we always knew what was being watched if it was on. And if no one was watching, it was off. So it was not a set that was left on, ever, unless someone was watching a specific thing. And you kind of had to know what you were going to watch, you know, before you turned on it. And then you treated it like a movie. You know, if I'm deciding to do this is what we're deciding to do, and we will do it. And so that's kind of one way to deal with the TV. Or just to decide not to use it at all. But you know, a radio can do the same thing. What does a radio do? Makes it so you don't have to have a silent house ever, or a silent car. right? The years when my kids were teenagers, I bought a car that did not have a radio, deliberately, so that when we were in the car, they had to talk to me. You know, we either sat in silence or they had to talk to me, one or the other. And it was really wonderful. I loved it. There was not one day that I missed that radio. Still to this day, I do have a radio in my van now, but I don't like to have it on. I'd rather be in silence.
I'm the opposite.
Yeah.
My car and my house and my radio and my kitchen are all on Minnesota Public and the classical music. To me, that's...
But you know, if you listen to classical music, it really doesn't affect your other thinking, does it? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can still pray, you can still think, you can still all of that. It doesn't clutter you.
It enhances it more.
Right.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful music.
Yeah. In Oklahoma, our public radio is all talk. Oh. Until 7 o'clock at night. We finally get classical music at 7 at night, but it's all talk during the day. And they're very interesting shows, you know, talk shows, but it's kind of clutter. Okay. It's kind of like yesterday, the photography class that I went to with Marion, one of the things she said to remember when you want to take beautiful photographs is unity of something, and she said the opposite of that is disunity, and she showed us a picture, you know, of one of our typical streets with, you know, McDonald's signs and all of that kind of stuff on it, and if you look around, the world that we live in is full of disunity, and clutter is the word that I would say. It's very, very difficult, I think, to hear God through the clutter.
And you mentioned our time, I think. We make a lot of choices what to do with our time.
You bet.
And we can fill it up with clutter. There's a lot of things that are meaningless that can take our time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And if we spend a lifetime doing that, it's kind of scary trying to make choices where that time wouldn't be cluttered, that it would be, you know, diving deep into yourself or really meaningful prayer. That becomes scary when you haven't been doing it a long time, if you've, you know, just been doing the clutter.
You can use selective hearing also.
Right. Well, mothers are really good at that, usually.
I have five children in 7 years, and I learned how to do selective hearing real fast.
You hear what you want, yeah.
Learned a few other things, too.
Yeah. You know, some people are better at that than others. And I think that that's almost a female thing, that we are able to do that. My husband cannot do that. He cannot cut out any sound. I mean, if you say something to him, he can't cut it out. He hears it. I mean, he doesn't want to sit in the kitchen and eat because he hears the refrigerator. I said, "You're kidding." The refrigerator, is there a sound? You know? And I go, "Oh, the refrigerator does make a sound, doesn't it?" But it was selective hearing on my part not to hear it. Whereas he hears all of those sounds. He's a doctor and he uses all those sounds to his advantage, but he doesn't know how to cut them out.
It was interesting. When we lived in Chicago, the church we were in, they'd never had the women's Bible study was. Anyway, so it got a young mother's group going, and we'd meet at the church. And we'd all bring our kids, and the kids would sit up in the corner and play. Well, one day when a woman came to visit, our Bible study was one, I had one child who was like a senior, junior, senior in high school. Uh-huh. And she said, "How can you stand it? How can you, you know, concentrate on this?" We said, "What?" And she was hearing those kids playing in the corner.
Right.
Well, the rest of us, we didn't hear it. We were doing the Bible study, and that was something we tuned out. She couldn't.
Yeah.
She couldn't do it because she wasn't used to it.
Right. Yeah. Part of it is that you're not used to it, and part of it is the way your brain is set up as well. I mean, we kind of know that now. We have this right brain and left brain that do different things, and it depends on the size of your corpus callosum, which is in the middle, how much of the two you use. And some people are more in one and more in the other. And if you do this selective listening, it's that you can go back and forth. You know, you're very adept at using both and going back and forth. So it's kind of the way your brain functions. It's really interesting, some of that stuff that they've been coming up with. Okay, I'm going to put this one on, which is a whole other direction I'm going. This is a little longer poem. This is my husband's favorite poem because it's about him. What you need to know. One, Something you should know before you marry. Does he want kids, and is he a Democrat? Most importantly, if it wasn't printed in red and you asked, what is February 14th special, would he recognize the day for lovers, or say instead you mean February 12th, don't you? You need to be aware of this in people from Illinois. Are any of you from Illinois yet? Okay. Some Land of Lincolners don't celebrate President's Day with Washington. Oh no, for them it's a sacred 12th and nothing but the 12th and nothing but. There'll be no heart-shaped candy, no roses or wine, and the fine dining will be on Lincoln log cake. Two, Aves, a different kind of saint from Valentine. We know him through simple stories. A penny return, studying by candlelight, a country lawyer's yarns outwitting the finest, telling stories to get out of trouble, telling stories that bind us together. Three, Abe stood tall and gangly, top hat on his head. Our marriage is much like that, often uncoordinated with wide open hands and clumsy feet, a body too willful at times to govern, a head too large to cover, and a mouth filled with stories. Like the time, the circling eagle thought I was prey after a mountain mudslide blocked our path, and I was weak and couldn't get home, and he took my hand, leading me through tears, step by step, retracing hours of mountain trail together. Four. What is story? Abraham would say, something more than the moral, more than the teller, something timeless, like a candle flickering all night, lighting the page upon which we write. Something truthful, like a tall tale, ducking its enormous head into a low doorway. Well, this poem kind of rambles around a lot, but it really ends up talking about story. And that's what I wanted to get around to here. Because something that was very common in our lives, I think, a generation or two ago was story. Especially before the TV. You know, people would tell stories a lot. And it's disappearing because we don't tell stories to one another very much. But I wanted to bring this up today because story, I think, is one way that in our everyday lives we can hear God. I mean, even at work, let's say you go and you work at IBM, you know, or whatever, and you have a coffee break and you're sitting around with somebody having some coffee. Somebody tells a story, don't they? I mean, it's usually a story that, hey, you know what happened on the weekend? I've got to tell you this story. This is so cool. And that's a lot of times, I think, the way we can hear God working in our world today is are through those stories of people who communicate with us. And, you know, sometimes not always all the time, but just those little bits, you know, story after church, story at break at work. Maybe even a story you hear on the radio, or even a story that you read in a book. But that's part of our everyday life, isn't it? Story. It's not, you know, stories aren't necessarily when we're down there in the dumps or when we're having a mountaintop experience. But I think that that's another way to hear God in our everyday life. Does anybody have a comment about that, or anytime you can think of a story that someone told you that really, really seemed like it was a little pearl from God? You know, I needed to hear that today. Well, it's something that you might want to think about, because I think that that's one of the ways that God works in our everyday life. Okay. This next one that I'm going to show is, this is called The Whole Day Life of a Lily. I wrote this for the daughter of one of my friends, and this daughter died. She's my friend and her daughter died, and her name is Sarah, so I've got it in memory of Sarah. And this is The Whole Day Life of a Lily, and here I'm talking about a daylily. Daylilies are out only one day, one whole day, and yet that's an incredible day for that daylily. That's what this is about. Morning air falls cold, petals unfold and settle in. She wonders where she's at, but knows to aim her stamen and pistils into interstitial space. Yellow gold as the sun's face, bold as fusion, bold as nuclear fusion, soft as dawn, yellow gold alert against the green grass lawn. A butterfly tickles gold on gold, waves wings to summon hummingbirds and insects, little girls and boys' ohs. Her lily bell alert welcomes them even when hurt by rain, wind, child, and chill. She stands her one day tall and still until day's end, then nods to what has become her home. Nods to the setting sun, the yellow gold sun against the blackening sky, and closes tight her lily bell, folding in petals, stamen, and pistils, and follows and falls, gold yellow lying on the green grass lawn, evening air falling on cold fading petals, gold sun gone. And I do this one just because this is my example of finding God in the ordinary. I mean, I've never been able to look at a daylily without just being awestruck at the fact that it's only out for one day. I mean, I think that way about insects, too. You know, some of them are out for, what, a couple weeks or whatever. I mean, that's their whole life, you know. And yet, for them, that's a whole. That's a whole. And when I see that lily, that speaks to me, that's finding God in the ordinary. That's a whisper. Remember, I talked in the beginning about sometimes God shouts at us and sometimes God whispers. And to me, this is a whisper, you know, to see a daylily. And then wake up the next morning and go out and say, which daylily opened today? They're so cool. But I love flowers. I could feel that way about almost any flower. Okay, all right, let's go to this one. Let's see what you need to know about this. Before I put this one on, this is called Ingredients That Count, and here at my reading the other night, I did read this one. But I wrote this for a good friend of mine who is what people would call pleasingly plump. She's not that, she's just pleasingly plump, but her husband constantly told her she was fat. Constantly let her know that she just was not the way she was supposed to be. And anyway, we'll read this and then we'll talk about it at the end. Ingredients That Count. You wanted me thin, so I slogged to a group who taught me to read the ingredient list on the cracker box and cookie tin. The magic is in the first four only. After that, only trace amounts provide taste, but no worry. I'm so sorry. I had to stop reading the list when I missed the joy of a butter kiss and chocolate mousse. It became abstruse as I slowly digested your ingredient list and found I was trace, and if left out, would not be missed. That's what she found, which is, it's a sad story. But they worked on it, and they're still together, and they have a nice marriage. But the reason I show that poem is because my question here is, what do we have to be able to learn about ourselves, you know, before we can hear God speaking? As a psychotherapist, I work with people who are in denial about all kinds of things. There's nothing wrong with my life. There's nothing, you know, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, denial after denial after denial. If we don't look at the truth, we can't really hear the truth. I mean, we have to be able to recognize it in order to hear it, in order to do something about it. And that's why I showed this poem, because this Ingredients That Count poem, I mean, I was there with my friend the day when she recognized this, and I was just so startled by her insight, and I went home and wrote a poem about it. But, you know, once she realized that she was going to all these groups because he was telling her to do it, that was a couple years ago. I talked to her on the phone about a month ago. She's now teaching aerobics. This is, if you knew this woman, this is just really unbelievable. She's now teaching aerobics, and she says she's down to a really nice weight, and it's because her husband doesn't say one word about it anymore. It is a non-issue anymore. And once it became a non-issue, then she could take it over instead of having him do it for her. And And it, my question here is, you know, what is it, and I would ask each of you to ask yourself, what is it that I'm not looking at in myself, or that I'm hiding, or, you know, that would not allow me to hear God's whisper, or to hear God shout? You know, what are those blockages that are there? And it's different for each one of us, and we're all really different that way.
Of course, this is like addictions, you know, you have to yourself get to the bottom and do it yourself. You can't.
Nobody can do it for you.
No.
No. And you have to realize that you have to get rid of the denials, isn't
right.
it? I'm not out of control.
Right.
I'm okay. No, you're not. But you have to say it yourself. Mm-hmm. That's right. Okay. I'm going to end with this poem. This is the last poem in my book. For those of you who don't, when I say my book, it's not in the library. They ordered it and it didn't come. But it's a poetry workbook for self-discovery and healing. And it's got 50 poems in it, and then it has 50 blank pages for people to write their own. You know, I give a suggestion of how to start a poem and then to write one of their own about the same subject. And so this is the last of those poems. It's called This Woman's Path. And before I put it up there, I want to talk again. Pastor Peter this morning talked about vocation and calling, that each one of us has a vocation, which again is not the way, maybe the way we make our living, but doesn't have to be. That's not what he's talking about. It's, you know, what we are really meant to do. We have a vocation, we have a calling. In this poem, this is called This Woman's Path, and I'm talking really about the same thing. What is the path that we go on? Some people will call it pilgrimage if you're talking about it in terms of religion or spirituality. What is your pilgrimage? You know, where did you start and where are you going? This poem is called This Woman's Path. Always the route around. Like a wildflowered country road meandering beside swamp. Sometimes becoming swamped when the cattails can't hold it all. Or a dirt road climbing sandstone cliffs past nests of black-backed eagles who stare in wonder at strange birds who follow dusty paths to such heights. This country road is less used than the superhighway to its right, dynamite blasted, forming its own drain lakes, getting where it's going without hesitation. This path slows migration, with its bumps, curves, softer shoulders, trapping tires in a hot summer afternoon's melting tar, or skidding too fast drivers into ditches of trapped snow. Travelers meet here, eye to eye, nod and wave, break for anything. This woman's path is slow-geared, less roadkill. And I, you know, when I wrote this, I mean, I was really writing this with a sarcastic tongue. I mean, my path has absolutely not been straight. It has been so wobbly and wiggly. In 32 years of marriage, I've lived in 20 houses, and those have not been moving across the street. You know, I mean, my paths have gone like this. And yet, I like where I am right now. This has been a pilgrimage. This has been a vocation. And I've had to listen after each one of those curves, you know, turns. I've had to listen very carefully, you know, where the next curve and the next turn was. But I think this is a really good metaphor for the world that we live in. I mean, look at what is the opposite to this? The superhighway. You know, it's dynamite blasted. It forms its own drain lakes. They're not natural lakes. You know, and you get there really fast. Nobody has to think or hesitate to get there on that superhighway. And that's where we spend most of our lives, isn't it, on this superhighway. So how do we get off that superhighway and get, you know, onto our own path? You know, find your own vocation and get onto this slow path where there is less roadkill, you know, and we can actually listen for the word of God.
Continue.
What I would
ask you to think about writing. Well, actually, let me, before we do that, let me read on page, on the opposite page, and this gives you an idea of what this book is like, where I have this poem right here, it's the last one of the book, I have written this, and then can you see the squiggly line under it? Mm-hmm. On the next page. Okay, this is what I have written. Accepting the road less traveled. And I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. The poet Robert Frost, who wrote these words, understood what it meant to find your own path. Sometimes that path will be longer than others. Sometimes it will be more dangerous. Sometimes more tranquil. Remember the mazes you did as a child, in which your pencil entered at the top of the page and you had to find the unobstructed trail out at the bottom of the page? Well, in real life, sometimes our travels take us off the page, or skipping over broad black lines, or using erasers to begin again. And then I say, write a poem about your personal journey in the shape of a wandering path, as indicated by the line drawn below. End the poem with a comma rather than a period. Because that path isn't done, and you're still going on that path. But that's another suggestion that you could write, you know, if you want to go off in a quiet place and write something. You know, think about, what is this path that I've been on? Have I had to use an eraser? You know, have I gone off the page? When did I get back on the page? And while I've been on that path, when have I heard the voice of God? And how did I do that? Did I have to quiet myself somehow to hear that voice? Or did it come screeching at me really, really loud? You know, God screaming and shouting at me. And then I would ask you also to think about writing something like this. And we could even talk about this for a minute if you like. Is God closer to me when life is good and exceptional? Or is God closer to me when I'm challenged with something, you know, or in adversity? Or is God closer to me in just plain, normal, everyday, get up at, you know, 7, go to bed at whatever, and stay in my routine? When is God closest to me? And you could write something like, I feel the wind blowing. You could start with words like that. I feel the wind blowing. Or I think I'll take a walk on my path. You know, just start with some very common words like that and see where your writing takes you. Since we do have a couple minutes, does anybody have some comments about that? When do you hear God best? When everything's going the way it's supposed to be going? Or when something is challenging you? Do we have an idea about that?
I think I hear God best when I'm just absolutely in joyful situations. And I can remember, mm-hmm. I have a son who's, 37. I can remember such a powerful feeling, and I probably can't say it without crying,
yeah.
When he was 3 weeks old, and I just sat in that bed,
yeah.
And held him.
Yeah.
You know, that had to be God.
Right.
And then I suppose the other time is the reverse, the total reverse, when, you know, you hit bottom, things are so bad that there is no place else to turn.
Right.
We had a 3-week-old grandchild that had surgery, emergency surgery,
yeah.
And we could not be there because we were on the East Coast. And you know, the only thing I could do was pray.
Uh-huh.
That was all.
Right, right.
So I guess, to me, it's both those times. Mm-hmm.
Right. We probably all, especially if we have kids, but probably because of other things as well, all felt that being totally helpless and just giving it over to God at some point. My son who works here, was an exchange student to Germany in his senior year of high school. And he calls us one day from a pay phone in Germany and says, my parents have kicked me out. I can't live there anymore, and I don't know what I'm going to do. And he calls us back an hour later and says, well, I found another boy in the school who says I can go live with him until the program finds me another home. So, I mean, these wonderful people just took him in a day. The people, the other people kicked him out because my son is 6'6", and he had walked into an antique lamp and broken it.
Ooh.
And they just, he was just out. Anyway, I took the program 2 months to find him another host home. And I just, you know, I was back here in the States. just take care of him. I mean, you cannot do anything. I know about it. You just feel totally helpless. And you're right. You feel, even though it's a horrible time for you because you're just, you know, your guts are just, you know, wrenching. You do feel somehow closer to God because of that. Yeah. And the first thing that you said about the beauty, you know, the beauty of your first child, you know, that goes without saying. I think all of us feel that elation, really. In some, I mean, I feel that when I hear the Hallelujah chorus every single time.
But you can't say they all feel it because mothers that get postpartum depression don't experience that.
That's right. That's right. They don't.
My daughter's having her second baby now. I'm realizing what she missed in the first one.
Right. That's right. And you know, I shouldn't glaze over that because it's absolutely true. We have a lot of people with attachment disorder who are never attached to parents, and the parents never felt that. Yeah. But what I'm saying is it's very common for us, for those of us who have had children and just really cherished them and feeling that. Yeah. Did you have anybody else?
Well, actually, though, then there's the ordinary. Mm-hmm. And I live on an island, and we have a pond. And every spring, you know, all of a sudden, out of no place, the frogs start croaking.
Oh.
And that's like
such a wonderful
so
sound.
Wonderful. I mean, you know, yes. To me, that's the ordinary.
I agree. Yeah, that is
it's
fabulous.
Like, wow.
Because not only is it a wonderful sound, but it means spring is coming.
Right.
I mean, it's lovely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We live on the same island.
Same house.
Same kids. I was denied that experience. I got to look through a little portal, you know. Actually, the first one, I wasn't even allowed out of the waiting room. But on the children, but we, for a while there, we raised cows. And when a calf would be born, usually it's at night. And you stay up with them, you know, because there might be trouble. And when it happens, and I swear that the bird stops. They're usually, the birds are singing in the early morning. It always happens in the early morning, about 3 or 4, before the sun rises. And the birds stop singing. There's total, complete silence. And you experience this, the closest as a man I get to this miracle.
Wow.
Same miracle. And
yes.
And I just absolutely overcome mm-hmm. with the miraculous, you know, I don't know why, whatever, I'm close to it. It's mm-hmm. really something.
It's awesome. Feeling of awe. Mm-hmm.
But this thing about prayer, answer to prayer, and the other thing I don't understand, I'm glad you shared that about men and silence. And because I'm an architect and I work, and I cannot work with any radio going or anything. I mean, I'm not able to separate those things.
Right.
I need silence. But in answers to prayer, I don't think I've ever heard an answer. It's always about 4 days later that I look back and I say, oh, I get it. You know, it was all there, but I could never see it at the time.
Uh-huh.
Maybe years later.
Uh-huh.
It's just amazing. I don't, it's like the answer, I guess I wouldn't trust an answer if I heard a voice or something.
Right.
But when I see
right.
results,
yeah.
That's an answer you can't deny.
Right. So it's almost when, you know, when someone over here asks what we pray for, it's almost a letting go, you know, that
yeah.
I'm putting this into your hands and that sometime I'm going to understand this, you
yeah.
know, and it comes.
Well, I had experience. I'm a recovering alcoholic, and you don't recover until you're willing. Do you reach the breaking point? We call it the bottom.
Yeah.
And my sponsor used to say the bottom is where you stop digging, because it could be anywhere. It could be after death if you want to do it that way.
Yeah.
But until somebody's willing to surrender, there's no, I mean, you might as well just go on and do what you're doing, mm-hmm. because you're not going to change, and you're not going to hand, and in order to change, you've got to hand it over to something. You know?
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, today's subject was how to listen for God, you know, in the ordinary, between the shouts and the whispers, and we've had a lot of people giving us some ideas. So I hope you have some, thoughts to go and write. There's nothing else that I've done this week. I would hope that I would, you know, get people to want to sit down with a piece of paper and a pencil and start writing some stuff. Don't ever think it has to be published. Just write it for yourself. You know, if you want to show it to somebody, that's a gift. You can do that.
Just do you journal, or do you just do poetry? I don't mean just, but I mean do you go both?
I do journal. I don't do as diligently as I would like to, because if I have extra time in the day, I will write poetry. But I do journal, and I find it extremely helpful. I'm not the kind of person who journals by saying, this is what I did, blah, 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 blah. But I certainly will journal by writing down, this is what I felt about, this is what I saw, connections, that kind of thing. I'm always writing down stuff on backs of napkins and receipts from stores, and I get little ideas all the time, and I'll write them down always.
I'm a strong believer in meditation, but I'm not able to do it well. I can't. You have to really empty yourself and be quiet for a long period of time, and I've never disciplined myself enough, but I think it'd be a tremendous way to become more aware of God in your life.
Right, I'm not going to go into that. I've taught meditation, but what you can do is little by little practice being in your home in a silent home. Turn the radio off.
Oh, I know how to do it.
Okay.
I know what I'm
saying. So you're not unfamiliar with the quiet in the silence.
And I think some of the lead-ins to meditation of the chanting and the Taizé method of prayer, where you repeat a certain mantra or prayer over and over and over again to empty your everything else.
Basically, scientifically, what it comes down to is you're trying to get your beta waves stopped and your alpha waves going. Okay, or am I wrong here? Yes, it's the alpha waves you want going. Okay, your beta waves are the ones that you use when you think and you analyze and you balance your checkbook. And your alpha waves are the ones that take you to La La Land. Mm-hmm. Okay, I was born in La La Land. I mean, I have to really, I have to discipline myself to get over to the other place. My husband was born in Beta Land. And we've kind of had to train one another how to get there. But if I want to write a poem, I mean, if it's the beginning of the day and I've said to myself, I'm going to write from, 8 to noon, I know how to get myself into alpha waves. I can take a hot, hot bath and it'll get me there. I can put on a Pete Seeger song and I will be there. But every person has to figure out their own ways how to get into their alpha waves. But that's what you need to do. It's a physical thing, and you can see it on a CAT scan. The waves in your brain are different. And some people, it's just much more difficult to switch from one into the other. Does that help you at all?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, well, we've gone over our time period. Thanks for everybody.
Thank you.
Oh, and there's a...